Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and at 13 hours GMT on Friday the 29th of May, these are our main stories. President Trump has been accused of glorifying violence over his Twitter response to demonstrations about the killing of a black man in Minneapolis. We'll find out why, and we'll hear how some African Americans want drastic reforms to the country's police. Also,
we've actually identified COVID-19 themed child exploitation forums, and they're actively discussing the COVID opportunity to find more victims.
The rise in child abuse during the global pandemic. Also in this podcast,
she talked about so much pressure being put on her and so many comments being given to her that there were times that she couldn't look in the mirror.
How a hugely successful singer-songwriter is challenging those who attack women over their body shapes. And at the deepest level ever found, an octopus of a type called Dumbo. As we record this podcast, the violent protests over the death of an unarmed African-American man at the hands of the police in the US city of Minneapolis show no sign of abating as demonstrators came out onto the streets for the third night running.
United we stand! Divided we fall!
The man, George Floyd, died earlier this week after a white police officer knelt on his neck as he lay in the street. Prosecutors say they're not ready to bring charges against four police officers implicated in his death. Mr. Floyd's death has prompted widespread public outrage and has reignited long-standing criticism of the way black Americans are treated by the police. Now, leading voices in the black community are saying the time has come for institutional change. Here's Dr. Bernice A. King, daughter of Martin Luther King.
Something like this is probably going to happen again. But the energy now has to be that we organize our strength, as my father said, into compelling power to deconstruct and reconstruct the whole criminal justice system, especially around law enforcement. Our legal system, our law enforcement system, particularly in the South, was based in keeping black people in check. And the use of this force and power has been used through generations. And so we have to reconstruct our police department so that police cannot get away with excessive force. There needs to be laws in place. There needs to be policies in place. We have to look at the whole structure and system around law enforcement and change it.
During the latest disturbances, the central police station was set alight. At a news conference, the mayor of Minneapolis, Jacob Frey, appealed to people to look out for their city and end the violence.
There is a lot of pain and anger right now in our city. I understand that. Our entire city recognizes that. What we have seen over the past several hours and the past couple of nights in terms of looting is unacceptable. Our communities cannot and will not tolerate it. These are businesses. These are community institutions that we need.
In a tweet, President Trump blamed what he called thugs, dishonoring the memory of the dead man. The president also threatened the use of force to restore order, warning when the looting started, the shooting started. He also accused the mayor of being weak. Asked about Donald Trump's comments, the mayor had this response.
Weakness is refusing to take responsibility for your own actions. Weakness is pointing your finger at somebody else during a time of crisis. Donald Trump knows nothing about the strength of Minneapolis. We are strong as hell. Is this a difficult time period? Yes, but you better be damn sure that we're gonna get through this.
So, the president's tweets have been facing criticism from the mayor of Minneapolis and from Twitter itself. Also in recent days, the company has labeled two other tweets from Donald Trump about voting laws in California as potentially misleading. In response, Mr. Trump announced plans to regulate social media companies and to make it easier for people to sue them. I asked our technology correspondent, Rory Kethlin-Jones, about the growing row.
Well, it's extraordinary, isn't it? For months, Jack Dorsey, the chief executive of Twitter, has been under pressure on all sides to do something about Donald Trump. People on one side have been pointing out that many of his tweets would seem to be violations of Twitter's rules, that other people would face action over them. He has responded in the past by saying different rules apply to public figures. And on the other side, he's been under pressure from Donald Trump and the conservatives in the United States, who feel that Twitter and other social media platforms are biased. So it was quite a moment when this fact-checking happened on Wednesday. After that, I thought maybe Twitter will hunker down and try to weather the storm, instead of which they've now upped the ante.
So do you think this is all going to end up in court?
Well, we've already seen the president promising action and in fact signing an executive order, which is a major move to try and alter the legislation, which is the basis on which lots of online firms operate. Legislation going back to 1996, which frankly gave permission to online firms to behave in ways which would not be allowed to, you know, traditional media companies, made them free from prosecution over the content that they posted because they painted themselves as platforms rather than publishers. Now, it seems unlikely that that will actually become a law in the United States very rapidly, but it sets the stage for further battles. And it leaves Twitter with a real dilemma. I mean, it has now gone down this path. If it's acting logically, it should continue to take action against the president's tweets. And I think every time he tweets something sensitive, everyone will be on tenterhooks to see what happens.
Rory Coughlin-Jones. The coronavirus and the lockdown measures put in place to deal with it have provided paedophiles with more opportunities to prey on children. There's been a global upsurge in reports of the uploading of indecent images of youngsters, with much of the abuse taking place in developing countries like the Philippines. Police there say the number of child abuse videos increased in March when the government imposed special measures. With so many schools closed and children across the world confined to their homes, they are particularly vulnerable to predators. Mike Thompson has this report, which contains details you might find distressing.
For most people, lockdown is an ordeal, but for some, it's a big opportunity.
You've got quarantined online child sex offenders in places like the UK who can spend more time on the internet.
John Tenego, Philippines-based director for the NGO International Justice Mission.
On the other side, you have vulnerable children who are confined at home. And we know from our casework in the Philippines that over 60% of the traffickers are their own parents and family members.
Philippines police rescue 7 children in a raid on a suspect's home. A young woman is arrested on suspicion of making child sex abuse videos for Western customers who often dictate the acts they want to see. She's the mother of 2 of the very young children.
Over 50% of the children are 12 years or younger, including babies. 2-month-old and a 3-month-old have been rescued.
Reports to Philippines police about all types of online child sex material nearly doubled in March when the lockdown there began. Emmeline Villar is Under Secretary at the Philippines Department of Justice.
Right now, there is a pending bill in the Senate and even in the House of Representatives to increase the penalty to death.
Does that bill have much support?
There is support for it.
Across the dark web, we've actually identified COVID-19 themed child exploitation forums. And one particular one that we're monitoring has grown more than 1,000 members. And they're actively discussing the COVID opportunity to find more victims.
Commander Paula Hudson of the Australian Federal Police says the downloading of indecent material of children there shot up by 86% just 3 weeks after lockdown came in. And supply can't keep pace with demand.
The internet traffic is so heavy that we've been finding that increased dark web systems are crashing, not coping with the amount of traffic. And so it's pushing them back into what we call the clear web, usual internet spaces to offend and groom.
The EU's Law Enforcement Cooperation Agency, Europol, has discovered significant lockdown increases in the downloading of child sex abuse material in Spain and Denmark. Its spokesman, Cathal Delaney, says grooming is becoming an increasing threat across Europe and has this message for parents.
Have a very frank and open conversation with their children about the dangers that they face online. It's really important that parents take a role in this. Parents and carers, people who are responsible, people who are with the children at the moment.
In the Philippines, where so many of the downloaded child sex abuse videos are made, life is slowly emerging from lockdown, though recovery is likely to take very much longer for young victims of this awful crime. Like Ruby.
It took me years to recover from that painful experiences. I was actually thinking that there's no point of living at all. They made my life so miserable from that damage that they did to me.
Ruby ending that report from Mike Thompson. The authorities in the US are, as we've heard, preoccupied with the tensions in Minneapolis as well as the pandemic. But President Trump and his top security officials have also been discussing whether to conduct a nuclear test explosion. So, why begin testing again? Baramazuro asked Ernest Monitz, a former US Energy Secretary and currently co-chair of the Nuclear Threat Initiative, which works to prevent catastrophic attacks and accidents with weapons of mass destruction.
I don't really see any good reason for it. One should understand that we have not had a nuclear test in the United States since 1992. And in fact, no country in the world other than North Korea has tested in this century. So there is kind of a de facto moratorium, except for North Korea. Every year, the secretaries of defense and of energy write a letter to the president, along with the head of the strategic forces, to give the president an evaluation as to the status of the stockpile. I was Secretary of Energy, and I signed those letters four times and advised by the directors of our weapons laboratories, we consistently stated that there was no foreseeable reason for testing because the stockpile, in fact, did remain safe and reliable. That remains the case today, and I certainly believe the only motivation possible for the United States to go forward and do a first test would unleash forces that would not be, frankly, to our benefit or to the security of the world.
Indeed, because it then implies that it's not the only test, but would be the start of many others. And one then wonders how Russia, China, North Korea, even Iran would then react and what this could trigger.
Russia and China in particular, in my view, would almost certainly test. And of course, we would lose a lot of the position we've been trying to establish in terms of getting North Korea to denuclearize. I do want to, however, say one thing about Iran. We should remember that Iran today, we are very confident, does not have a nuclear weapon. That's the way we want to leave it. And certainly United States testing would really shake the foundations of nonproliferation very, very seriously.
Is there some thinking, perhaps, in the United States that threatening some form of nuclear test could be used as leverage to get China or Russia to come to some form of negotiation?
Well, that was the report. The report was that the meeting was to evaluate whether doing a nuclear test would, in fact, provide leverage for getting negotiations going with Russia and China.
Is there any validity in that?
I certainly see none. I think it's likely to be the opposite. And I hope that, in fact, the administration officials reach the same conclusion. The arms control architecture certainly has gotten a bit wobbly, shall we say, over the last few years. The last remaining major piece is called the New START Treaty between the United States and Russia, which puts limits on deployed nuclear arms and delivery systems. And also, very importantly, and not emphasized enough, provides direct verification measures for both sides. That will expire in February of 2021, unless President Trump and President Putin extend it. So we are very much hoping President Trump will, in fact, extend that. President Putin has already declared that he is prepared to extend the treaty with no conditions. And so we hope the United States will join that and provide the opportunity for building the next round of arms control agreements.
Ernest Monitz, co-chair of the Nuclear Threat Initiative, speaking there to Bola Mazuro. Still to come on this edition of our podcast.
It was a commercial agreement to tie up and stroke a semi-naked man in his underpants with a broom.
A very unusual story, to say the least, from Australia. We'll find out more later. Australia is now seeing very few new cases of COVID-19, and across the country, restrictions are being gradually eased. In New South Wales, the country's most populous state, students have returned to full-time face-to-face learning in the classroom. Our Australia correspondent Shaima Khalil looks at how schools and families are adjusting.
The start of the school day here at St. Columba's Primary is what you'd expect, the rush of parents and children. Some are running, excited to be back in school after 9 weeks at home. Others with very sleepy eyes. And a couple who cling on to their mom and dad, still not used to being back.
Good morning. How are you going?
Good.
Have a good day.
The principal, Bernard Ryan, is welcoming everyone in. There's something different about this very familiar place, though. Parents aren't allowed onto the school grounds. It's just a quick goodbye and a hug at the gates. Students are greeted with hand sanitizer as they walk in, and there's no morning assembly.
In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.
In this Catholic school, announcements and prayers now happen in small groups inside the classroom.
Boys and girls, remember to sanitize your hands before you eat. It is very important.
Social distancing with children in school is very tricky, if not impossible. The focus here is on good hygiene. And while teachers can't avoid being close to their students, they are trying to maintain a safe distance from each other.
Okay, let's have a look. You're almost finished.
Okay. Rachel Lockery is the Year 5 and 6 teacher at St. Columba's.
We need to obviously keep the children safe and ourselves safe, so we have to make sure that the children are sanitising their hands and washing their hands regularly, and obviously making sure that our workspaces are always clean. Probably my main concern is the virus being brought into the school.
Lily and Gianna are in Year 6, and even though it's not the same, they tell me it's a welcome change from having to study at home.
Well, it's good being back at school because then we can see everyone and face-to-face learning is easier to understand.
I've really enjoyed it. It's been exciting. A bit different to when I left, but yeah.
The playground is buzzing during break time. Something Bernard Ryan, the school principal, tells me they really missed here.
It's been fantastic to have the children back at school face-to-face learning. The relationships, the children are seeing their friends again, they're seeing their teachers, but it's all being done in a very safe and hygienic way.
Did you miss the noise?
I missed the life, yes, I did. A school's a very boring place without children in it. It's just nice. We feel energised again as teachers having our children back with us.
Despite the relatively low number of COVID-19 cases in Australia, the risk of infection remains. Some Sydney schools have had fresh coronavirus cases this week and had been forced to close.
Hey, boys. Hi. How's your day?
All right. Okay.
For some parents, it's not going back to school that worries them. It's how their children get there. Twins Peter and Matthew used to take a bus, then a train. But now their mother, Michelle, does the drop-off and the pickup.
Being in contact with strangers and I guess with the winter coming, there's an increase in just the normal cold and flu season, and so lots more people coughing and sneezing and sniffling around as well. That doesn't improve things either. So I think if you can, it's good to drive them to school.
That report from Shaima Khalil. The singer Billie Eilish, at just age 18, is already a 5-times Grammy Award winner with millions of fans and a huge following on social media. Her style is flamboyant, with dyed green hair, extra long nails and baggy designer clothes. But like many other women around the world, she's often faced body shaming and criticism over her appearance. Well, Billie has just released a short film, originally shown during her concerts, addressing the issue. In it, she wears a black hoodie and stands against a black background and challenges her critics.
Some people hate what I wear. Some people praise it. Some people use it to shame others. Some people use it to shame me.
Well, for reaction to that video, Bola Mazuro spoke to Kat Harborne, the co-host of the BBC's Naked podcast, which is all about body positivity.
Yeah, it's a really powerful video, isn't it? And the way that she speaks to the camera and she says, do you know me? Do you really know me? You have opinions about my opinions, about my music. I think she's basically, like I'm sure most of us would be, pretty sick about people having an opinion about what she looks like. She is a pop star. She wants to be known for her music. She's already won 5 Grammys and she's only 18. And I think when we see somebody in the public eye, it's so easy to forget that they're a real person. If you see somebody doing really well, you presume they must have a whole entourage around them looking after their every whim. But she's 18. She's a teenager. Just remember what it felt like to be 18 and how body conscious you probably were. And you think you know everything, don't you, at the age of 18, but you learn so much as you go through your 20s and 30s.
And it's interesting because she kind of covers a large demographic, not just the 18-year-olds or the 20-somethings, even 30-somethings and older, and the much younger ones. And we see this, especially among young girls. You know, anybody who has a young daughter will know, you know, how they have this angst, if you like, about the way, wherever they are in the world, there's always an issue. Is it increasing or is it decreasing for young women, do you think?
I think it's really difficult with the advent of social media, because now we all have Photoshop in our pocket. I could take a photo of myself straight on and you'd see all my double chins. If I lift my phone up and do it from above, I will look different and maybe I will choose the very best shot. So I think we're all probably guilty of choosing the very best picture of ourselves and presenting that. But I think if you're then at home feeling like you don't fit in, or as I did when I was growing up, feeling like, oh, I'm overweight and I don't fit in with all my friends who are really skinny and I want to wear the same clothes they're wearing, it's so easy to then feel negative about yourself. And I think one of the heartbreaking things for me about Billie Eilish is that she talked about so much pressure being put on her and so many comments being given to her that there were times that she couldn't look in the mirror. And so she talked about wearing the big baggy clothes, and she said previously that she didn't ever want the world to know anything about her. That's why she wore these big baggy clothes. And then she said nobody can have an opinion because they haven't seen what's underneath. So I think this is a real hit back to say, no, you can't keep having these opinions about me.
Kate Harborne, co-presenter of the BBC's Naked podcast, speaking to Bola Mazuro. The coronavirus might mean you've not been able to get a drink at your favourite bar for a while, but for the people who actually work there, things are most likely a lot more serious. And in the US state of Georgia, one bar owner looked around her empty saloon and found everything she needed to make a difference. Jonathan Savage has more.
On a hot summer's day on Georgia's Atlantic coastline, Tybee Island is just the place to unwind, and the sandbar with its surf shack decor, neon sunset hues and liquor bottles stacked high behind the bar seems like an ideal base from which to do that. You could spend a lot of money in a place like that, or like thousands of other customers, you could sign a dollar bill and pin it to the wall. Owner Jennifer Knox calls them love notes.
People that leave their love notes just come back every year and maybe leave another one or take a picture with their dollar. It was a very special moment at the time.
She means, of course, the time before COVID-19. The sandbar closed down when the state issued stay-at-home orders. Jennifer laid off 6 members of staff but wanted to do something to support them. So she and some friends carefully took down every single dollar. It took 3.5 days and took the pile to the bank.
And we took down $3,714. I couldn't believe it.
So what did it mean to the 4 former bar staff and 2 musicians who Jennifer was able to help?
They absolutely freaked out. It was so emotional. There were so many tears. It was a game changer for these people.
And that ends that report from Jonathan Savage. Now, creatures that live in the depths of our oceans are, to be frank, often very odd-looking. But now a familiar animal, an octopus, has been spotted by cameras at a depth of 7,000 metres swimming along the Indian Ocean floor. It's a Dumbo octopus, one of a group of species so-called because of its long ear-like fins just above its eyes, making it look like the 1940s Disney cartoon character, which was a flying baby elephant. Jonathan Amos, our science correspondent, told me more.
Well, it was discovered on an expedition to the deepest places in world's oceans a couple of years ago, done by a Texan financier. And as he was doing this in a sort of adventurous style, he also was doing science as well. And they were throwing what are called landers over the side of his research ship. And these landers have got instruments, they've got cameras on, and they sink down to the bottom of the sea and they're baited. So they put a dead fish or something on the end of a long pole, and then they sit and they wait and they watch to see what comes past. And to their great surprise, at a depth of almost 7,000 metres, an octopus swam by, and they really weren't expecting it at that depth.
I mean, should we be surprised?
Not really. There have been, evidence of octopus behaviour at very great depths. The problem is you really need to capture something on camera, and the best image that we had prior to this was just over 5,000 metres down, an image that was taken in the 1970s, black and white. And so all of those other bits of data, those other bits of evidence that we've had, you know, bits of octopus, other animals that have been pulled up that have octopus inside them because they've eaten them or something like that. You can't say definitively, yes, this animal is at that depth. But there's no doubting this because it's right there in front of the camera. And we know the very precise depth at which this is occurring. So, yeah, it's great to see Dumbo at 7 kilometres down.
Jonathan Amos, our science correspondent. Now it's time for our news from elsewhere when we look at some of the less reported stories from around the world. Joining me now down the line is Crassy Twig from the BBC monitoring team, which follows media in many languages. And your first story, Crassy, is from the Indian city of Calcutta, which bore the brunt of last week's cyclone, didn't it? Many parts of the city were devastated, including one of Asia's biggest book markets. Tell us about it.
The book market is called College Street, and it's a famous book market in Kolkata. It's a kilometre-long stretch housing hundreds of bookseller stalls. And apparently books worth over $650,000 have been damaged, something that's upset local residents who know what an important part of the city and its academic hub it is. And many people shared their grief on social media, saying how heartbreaking it was to see those pictures of precious pages floating in dirty water. But a few days after the cyclone hit, more hopeful images started doing the rounds on social media. Hundreds of books laid out on the road to dry in the sun. And it turns out this is quite a painstaking task. As one bookstall owner explained, each page had to be separated so that they don't stick together. The local community, too, has been busy helping. Several fundraising initiatives have been organized to help booksellers recover some of their losses. Shop owners, too, are now finding new ways of reaching customers, and some of them are beginning to sell their books online for the first time. So despite this terrible situation where you have a natural disaster striking in the most difficult of times, the local community of book lovers is positive about the rebuilding work that's going on. And as one bookstall owner put it, College Street is recovering its indomitable spirit.
And let's move now to Turkey, which has seen some positive signs, hasn't it, with images of animals roaming freely in urban spaces, prompting people to talk about what? An environmental healing amid the coronavirus restrictions in the country.
That's right. Images of wild animals in areas where humans have retreated during lockdown have gone viral in recent weeks. Dolphins, for example, were filmed playing in the Bosphorus, which is very unusual and made only possible because of a big drop in maritime traffic at the moment. There was another viral video that showed a flock of sheep invading the province of Samsun, traveling on main roads. And also people are noticing cleaner skies, clear waters, and it all has been explained combined with restrictions to human activity. Air pollution in Istanbul, for example, fell by more than a quarter between March and April, and there have been similar drops in other parts of the country. But there are fears that any improvements that we're seeing at the moment are temporary and will probably be reversed once lockdown measures are lifted.
Crassie, thank you. That was Crassie Twigg of our monitoring team bringing us this week's news from elsewhere. And finally, to a very interesting story out of Australia. A man who accidentally broke into the wrong house after he was hired to stage a home invasion to enact part of a sexual fantasy has been acquitted in court. Kate Gregan told me more.
Well, Val, this is certainly not a story you hear every day. The man Terence Leroy and an accomplice were offered up to $3,000 by a man they met on Facebook who wanted to be tied up in his underwear and stroked with a broom. Now, this would be all well and good, except that the client moved to another address after the initial contact was made and didn't update the two men. So back in July 2019, when this happened, these two guys entered a home on the street of the original address just after 6 o'clock in the morning. The men came inside and called out the name of their client, but the resident turned on the light and must have been quite alarmed when he saw the pair standing above his bed with machetes. But the guys soon realised the error and said, "Sorry, mate," before shaking the resident's hand and leaving.
And what happened next?
Well, the two men did then drive to the correct address where apparently the client cooked bacon, eggs and noodles. But a short time later, the police arrived and arrested the pair. But of course, this has now been played out in court where the judge ruled that the evidence did not suggest the men's actions in the first property were intentional. And Mr. Leroy was found not guilty of entering a home armed with a weapon. During the court appearance, a lawyer for Mr. Leroy said it was a commercial agreement to tie up and stroke a semi-naked man in his underpants with a broom. Entry was not with intent to intimidate.
Kate Gregan reporting there. I can't follow that. So that's it from us for now. There'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or any of the topics we've covered in it, do send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.